Thank you. I should say thank you again to Professor Scheid for sponsoring my visit here. It's been extremely generous and a wonderful visit. And I should apologize again for not doing this in French then. My talk today is based on the third chapter of a book I'm finalizing on Marie Curie, which has the working title of Making Marie Curie, Intellectual Property, Celebrity Culture, and the Power of Print. And if someone of you were here last week, I apologize if there are any overlaps from what I was saying at that time. There should not be too many of them, or not too long, I hope. And I should also say that, unless stated otherwise, all dates that I'm referring to is from 1921 then. On May 11th, 1921, Marie Curie arrived in America, or Dollaria, as Einstein called the United States at the time. She went back there again 8 years later. The week-long passage across the Atlantic had been comfortable but uneventful. However, there had been plenty of excitement preceding her departure from Cherbourg on the USS Olympic. A few days earlier, she had received a magnificent send-off at the Opera, the national manifestation organized by Chaussée Tout in her honor, but to the glory of French science, was a celebration of her upcoming trip that included an impressive list of speakers and the presence of everybody who was anybody in post-World War I Paris. The event even produced considerable proceeds, estimated at around 50,000 francs, for the benefit of the Radium Institute. A touching poem by Maurice Rostand rounded off the first and more formal part of the celebration. Written to the glory of Madame Curie, it was performed, of course, by Sarah Bernhardt. 10 years had passed since the failed candidacy to the Académie and the turbulence of the Langevin affair, and Curie had risen from it all as Phoenix from the ashes. Following her dramatic and extensive hospitalization after having accepted the 1911 Nobel Physics Prize in Stockholm, she took Irène and Eve along for a self-imposed exile in England, staying with the physicist Hertha Ayrton in London and Hampshire. When she returned to Paris, life went more or less back to normal. Then World War I erupted in 1914, putting plans for the Radium Institute on indefinite hold, and her at the front with the Petite Curie. With armistice, she had to begin anew, and she would do so with the assistance of the United States, a country unscathed from the war, epitomizing like no other the belief in the overlaps between pure and applied science. And of course, there was no other country where modernity, innovation, and celebrity was as far advanced and embraced. Despite failing health and a constant preoccupation with money, her two trips to the United States during the 1920s had a formative influence on her ability to further consolidate her persona and her legacy. This goes especially for her first visit in 1921, the purpose of which was to receive a gift from the women of America, who by popular subscription had collected $100,000 for the purchase of 1 gram of radium, the most valuable material on Earth. As a comparison, this is, as if a crowdsourcing campaign today succeeded in raising the equivalent of the 2012 Nobel Prize sum of 1.2, or the equivalent thereof, for a worthy $1.2 million for a worthy scientist somewhere. But then America's women scraped together twice the amount Einstein received for the 1921 Nobel Prize in Physics, and it was all for her own use. In some sense, Marie Curie now reaped the reward of the decision made by her and Pierre Curie in 1902, 20 years after ceding radium to others by abstaining from patenting their discovery and the processes of its extraction. The Curie's disinterested action of sharing information and samples was collectively reciprocated when the United States female populace gave Marie Curie an equally disinterested gift in return. Now, this reciprocity, laden with a fascinating set of symbolic and financial gestures, is the main reason why the 1921 tour and the American gift has a very important role to play, I think, in the overall story I'm trying to tell in my book. We know that the circulation of radium and the circulation of Marie Curie, the person slash persona, was sustained by a complex interplay between divergent economies, legalities, and values. And yet, the American gift was something quite unique. peripherally related both to a traditional science economy of academies, prizes, and honorary degrees, intermingling with state and industry initiatives. This was a public campaign using all the mechanisms of the mass press and celebrity culture to enlist the interest and monetary investment of women across the social spectrum. Best thought of as an informal economy with significant formal consequences, these consequences turned out to be both more complicated and more rewarding than Curie could ever have anticipated. Curie brought Irène and Eve along on the USS Olympic to help her cope with the bus and the media coverage that awaited her over there. Crucial additional support was provided by the fourth passenger accompanying the Curie trio, the woman who was behind the whole idea to begin with, and who is seen here standing between Irène and Eve holding Curie's hat, the New York socialite and editor of the women's magazine The Delineator, Marie Mattingly Maloney, always nicknamed Missy. And she also, I spoke last week about the various authorship identities that Curie has took on, and of course, Missy Brown Maloney was always formally known as Mrs. William Brown Maloney, so she too changed a bit the names depending on the context in which she prefigured. So it was because of her that Curie had spent a week on the luxurious paquebot preparing for a breakneck six-week-long US tour by writing letters back home, dreaming of summers in Bretagne and of grandchildren. As this image perhaps also shows, when the small entourage disembarked in New York, they were met by what Eve Curie remembered as a foule énorme. The New York Times reported that while Marie Curie looked visibly ill from seasickness and wore a severely plain dress, despite her age of 53, she was energy personified as she patiently posed in a deck chair for the 26 photographers who fired away at their cameras. Marie Curie had finally arrived in New York. Curie and Maloney first met in the spring of 1920 when the indefatigable journalist prevailed on Stéphane Lausanne, the editor-in-chief of Le Matin, to secure a meeting with the famous but notoriously shy scientist. In her own account of their first Paris encounter, Maloney remembered how their discussion quickly turned to the topic of America, a country Curie told her guest that she had wanted to visit for some time. Nobody knew better than Curie that since the discovery of carnotite ores in Colorado and Utah in 1913, and before substantial findings in Congo would lead the Union Minière de Haute-Katanga to basically monopolize the production of radium in the 1930s, the US was the world's largest producer of radium. Maloney dramatized the conversation in her introduction to the Pierre Curie book with her usual flair and by having Curie account for all the radium in the US. America, she said, has about 50 grams of radium. Four of these are in Baltimore, six in Denver, seven in New York. She went on naming the location of every grain. And in France, I asked. My laboratory, she replied simply, has hardly more than a gram. You have only a gram, I exclaimed. I? Oh, I have none, she corrected. It belongs to my laboratory. I suggested royalties on her patents. Surely she had protected her right to the processes by which radium is produced. The revenue from such patents should have made her a very rich woman. Quietly, and without any seeming consciousness of the tremendous renunciation, she said, there were no patents. We were working in the interests of science. Radium was not to enrich anyone. Radium is an element. It belongs to all people. Now, last week, I spoke of the decision not to patent radium and the rhetorical force that Curie gave this decision in the Pierre Curie biography. Here again is another reference to this disinterested ideology, the irony of this tremendous renunciation depriving Curie of her precious element was not lost on the entrepreneurial New Yorker. Back home, Maloney knew what needed to be done for her idol, but she felt too overcome with emotion to approach Curie directly with her ideas. At least, that is what Henri-Pierre Rocher, the author of Jules et Jim, told Marie Curie in a long letter he wrote on Maloney's behalf. According to Rocher, Meloni wanted to attract, and she can do it, he added in parentheses, just to underscore that this offer was not without real substance, a gift to Curie's Institute in the form of radium and money. And then he continued, the American editor wanted to publish a history of Curie's life. Of course, Rocher quickly added, Meloni would work with just as much zeal to ensure that the gift materialized, even if Curie decided against writing her autobiography. So it's, and this again is the image of the American edition of Pierre Curie, and it's worth keeping in mind that this, at this stage, what Meloni wants Curie to do is to write about her own life, not write about Pierre Curie's life. So just to make that clear. Quid pro quo or not, Meloni's solution was clearly a two-front proposition. The gift of radium ensured that Curie could continue her research for the greater good of mankind. Putting her in touch with the right kind of publisher would earn her royalties by protecting her own life story. Agreeing to write some sort of autobiography made perfect sense to Rocher, who told Curie to grasp this opportunity with both hands because, and I quote, if you do not tell this story yourself, it will be invented one day. And if she abdicated such narration to others, he warned, they would only tell anecdotes and exaggerate the whole legend thing. And it's a surprisingly irreverent touch, I think, that he put the legend in quotation mark in his letter. So from the very beginning then, Meloni established two trajectories around the US tour. One was the economy of the gift and one was the economy of print. And to see to that these two sort of came together as a seamless whole was then Meloni's mission, if you will. Last week, I showed this cover of Pierre Curie, for which Curie had signed a contract with Payot on September 1st, 1920. Now, the book rendered her a royalty of 10% on sales and a fixed sum of 1,000 francs, which were payable in two installments, half on delivery of the manuscript and the other half at the time of publication. What is interesting in the contract with the publisher is that the standard clause pertaining to translation has been crossed over with a pen and replaced with a new text in the margin, which stipulates that Marie Curie reserved all translation rights and the right to all proceeds that would follow from these rights. Maybe, I have to double check, but hints of a prosperous American market standing by, and of course having met Meloni in the spring, may have influenced Curie's translation clause, indicating or giving some indication of just how conscious she was about her international reputation and the care she took in watching over and controlling the Curie name, which of course is a recurring theme during her career. Following Rocher having broken the ice, Meloni now wrote Curie describing how she, as a first step, was preparing an article about the scientist for the January issue of The Delineator. This is the May 1920 number issue of The Delineator, just to show you what it looked like around this time. It was a woman's magazine with fashion, reportage, a bit like Femina that I mentioned last week. When Meloni sent the finished Delineator article to Paris for approval a few weeks later, she asked if Curie, provided that the funds could be had, would consider traveling to the US to accept a gift of radium. Such a trip, Meloni added, would also stimulate sales of your book. The answer came back positive. If you should be successful in getting radium for me, Curie wrote, she promised to do all she could to travel to America to receive her gift. Meloni now has what she needs to set the wheels in motion. She establishes the Marie Curie Radium Fund to oversee the raising of funds and the program for Curie's visit. But she has also learned that the French government was buying up large quantities of radium, and many of her potential donors now wondered if this fundraising might be superfluous. Do you still need radium for your institute? She asked Curie nervously. Undaunted, and now follows a long period of silence on part of Curie, and that happened fairly frequently, actually, during their more than decade-long correspondence. But undaunted by the period of silence that followed, Meloni continued sending out information, so she continues sending letters to Curie. She had received several pledges for contributions. There was not enough money in the bank right now to buy the radium, but she expected to be able to do so in April. She had formed a committee of scientists, on which there were only men, to supplement the committee of women, and you can perhaps make out the listing of the names on either side of the letterhead on this letter. The same publishing houses as before remained interested in her autobiography, etc., etc. Still no response from Curie on the important question if she still needed the radium. But ever since Maloney first told her, "I hope to make a big material reward for you," in her letter from September 1920, variations on this theme featured prominently in their communications. Maloney never forgot to clarify that financial reward of some sort would be involved. And while the American editor might have left that first rendezvous with a slightly skewed impression of Curie's poverty, and Curie said as much as herself, it's hard to understand why Maloney constantly reverted to an economic argument unless she felt it would somehow resonate with her heroine in Paris. "Stay away from the lecture bureaus and limit yourself to talks for the science community," she advised Curie, and for two reasons. First, the latter share a common interest with you, and second, and no less important, they have foundations which enable them to pay you considerable sums for any talks you may be willing to make in their institutions. Sometimes the well-meaning Maloney went overboard with her plans, but she was a public relations genius who instinctively understood how important it was for Curie to attract not just any kind of money, but the right kind of money. And then on January 31st, Curie finally replied. She thanked Maloney profusely for all her hard work and assured her that the gift, if realized, would be of great use to her. Unfortunately, the French radium in question was reserved for medical use in hospitals and still left her without any for pure scientific research. Whether or not such radium should be bought in the US or Europe, a question Maloney had raised, was inconsequential to Curie. But another point was not. Curie was most adamant that she would prefer to receive from your committee the radium that you have purchased yourself and not the sum destined for its purchase. Because the gift was for pure science, the exchange of money had to be avoided. Radium did remarkable things, and if anyone could make it outperform itself even more, it was Marie Curie, provided she had absolute control of its uses, of course. And part of the allure of the commodity form radium was its scarcity and exorbitant price at the time, something Curie, of course, knew better than anyone. Yet she was associated and wanted to be associated not with the radium craze of popular culture in the shape of countless books, plays, as well as, of course, cosmetics, but with the fluorescent properties and the constant mysterious radiation that captured the imagination when radium was discovered 20 years earlier. So it is essential for her to receive the radium, and this she makes very clear in her correspondence, rather than just the money to be able to purchase it herself. Curie could actually afford not to care, but Maloney was in a less enviable position, having to raise the funds to match US prices, even though she wrote to Curie that Belgium recently had bought radium in Russia for 40,000 a gram. I think this is actually a very important part of the whole gifting idea that happens here at this stage, that Curie is extremely aware of, you know, receiving a gift in a particular way and not in another way. During early spring, news of Curie's stateside visit began appearing in the US press, but it was not as if the information was 100% reliable. The New York Times described her golden and abundant hair and claimed erroneously that Curie had a Swedish mother. March 13, the same newspaper made a really embarrassing mistake when they happily reported that Pierre Curie was to accompany his wife on the trip. So Maloney and Curie keep up their correspondence, they discuss various publishing opportunities, and Curie then writes to Maloney and telling her that she had been approached several times by a US publishing company called Kedik, who had asked her to write a popularized account of radium. And then she asked Maloney, do you think that a book in this genre could be interesting enough for a big print run? Now, her apparent willingness to accommodate a popular book of this kind into her busy schedule could be a way of keeping Maloney's interest alive, keeping her happy, but you could also interpret it as indicative of how much her identity as an author at this time began or rested on mastering the particular genre of vulgarisation, or popularization, if you will. In the beginning of March, when it's becoming obvious now that there will be a trip, the two women began to discuss more practical matters. And at this juncture, the gift was no longer a secret. Maloney had actually asked Curie not to speak of the gift in France, so it was a secret for quite some time. And Curie now begins to sound worried that some might think that the radium is intended for the university and not for her. And now she begins sort of emphasizing that this gift should be made out to her personally. And she writes, if the gift is made to me, it must be indicated in the text of the donation what my power is to dispose of this gift and within what limits. So exercising control over this gram of radium is crucial to Curie, and she desperately seems to want to keep it out of the hands of the university. Then she writes, we can arrange all of this when I arrive, and in a confident afterthought, the same goes, of course, for all other gifts I may receive. On the same day that Curie shared her wish list with Maloney, the New York Times reported that the committee in charge of the campaign preferred it if the $100,000 would be made up of many small contributions rather than of the few large ones that could be secured so much easily. Now, this is a curious declaration, I think, because why would you choose a more difficult path to secure the $100,000 unless the strategy of relying on the generosity of the rich and famous had failed? And initially, Maloney wanted to raise the $100,000 by enlisting the support of 10 wealthy women from her own circle of friends in New York, pledging $10,000 each, a huge sum, of course. It was now clear that her fundraising among the New York glitterati had nosedived. But Maloney had a knack for turning setback into resounding success. Yes, she had misjudged her friends' willingness to open their checkbooks, but for the campaign as a whole, her stroke of bad luck was fortunate indeed. Suddenly, the gift was no longer given by the Park Avenue clique, but a unique bequest from Middle America. The American gift became a vehicle for a kind of populist promotion of science, a way for the flapper and socialite, shop girl and factory worker, to make the research of one of the world's most famous scientists possible. A scientist celebrity who was also, or so the story went, a woman and mother just like them. Of course, strictly speaking, Curie was nothing like them. And one of Maloney's accomplishments was that she invented ordinary Curie in a way, a woman who had long-standing relationships with the ultra-rich. I mean, Andrew Carnegie had funded her work for years, the Rothschilds too. But to get mainstream America to open their purses required greater visibility, and it changed the direction of the tour into a much more public event. One proof of Maloney's clever marketing campaign was that she organized a public bidding for the purchase of Curie's radium. So as the tour approached, small advertisements appeared in the national newspapers requesting sealed bids for supplying 1 gram of radium or any fraction thereof for Madame Marie Curie. 3 radium producing companies were said to have participated in this bid, and while the final sum was not disclosed, it was reasonable to expect that the winner of the bid, the Standard Chemical Company, had offered a discount of around $20,000. One of Maloney's most inspired ideas, however, worthy of an article or a project onto itself, I guess, was called the so-called Radium Book, where institutions and individuals who had contributed to the fund signed their names as an inspired way of promoting this idea of an egalitarian rather than elitist campaign. Consider, for instance, for the symbolic power in how Maloney writes about a wealthy woman walked into the Equitable Trust Company with $1,000 to deposit, and her name was listed next to that of one of the cleaning women of a downtown office building who had put down $1. So, you know, this is the juxtaposition of the really rich and the sort of really poor who contribute to Marie Curie. And with this popular subscription angle in place, the campaign became a triumphant moment in which the general female public became this major funding body of science. Inherited or hard-earned, it was the money of American women en masse that would buy one unique woman, Marie Curie, a gram of radium. Radium extracted and produced in the United States, but given in expectation of being used to pursue exactly the kind of pure science that once had resulted in its discovery. But that wasn't all. Everything turned on this collective of women gladly accepting that the radium in question would leave their own country in the hands of a woman who would use it for research, not in the United States, but in France. It's a measure of Marie Curie's status at the time and Maloney's exceptional marketing savvy that this idea could be sold, as it turned out, even oversold to American women. Then on May 20th, Marie Curie stood on the White House lawn and accepted her American gift from the hands of President Harding. Actually, what she received was a piece of paper, an ornate certificate for radioactive material, and a box, and you can see this box today at the Curie Museum. The gram of radium was, of course, too dangerous to handle and would later be delivered straight to the steamer, to the boat, on her departure. In his speech, Harding emphasized that he was giving her a return gift for her work with radium. Yet, it wasn't altogether true that the American gift was completely altruistic, that there were no expectations on part of the donors. Pure science was all very good, but what was expected of her was not just any kind of research, any kind of speculative use for the advancement of theory, but research that would eventually produce a cure for cancer. Thus, the gift was intended to be followed by another gift by her, where Curie was supposed to labor on cancer so that the cycle could sort of continue, that the gift kept on giving, as is, you know. Finding a cure for cancer was the kind of applied science that made pure science understandable. And it led to spectacular headings in the press, some of which came straight from the horse's mouth, as it were, from Maloney herself, who in the April issue of the Delineator had left little to the imagination. That millions shall not die, exclamation mark, was a not so subtle reference to the fact that radium was indeed seen as the great healer of the scourge of modern life, cancer. But Maloney knew better than anyone that first and foremost, what she was selling was a wonderful story, as she put it, and few audiences worked as hard as Curie's. Sororities were named after her, and three typists at the Delineator copied her Pierre Curie manuscript without asking for any remuneration than inscribed photographs. There was almost nothing Maloney could not get people to do for Curie, or that they volunteered to do themselves on her behalf. But she also inspired mixed feelings, and it has been argued, there was a book published a few years ago called the Madame Curie Complex, which argues that there was a sort of backlash in the US following Curie's visit, that this borderline anxiety was produced between hope and hopelessness, if you will. And there are traces of such emotional oscillation in the correspondence at the Curie archives. A letter Curie once received from Maloney's secretary, for instance, Ruth Beard Addis, who wrote, "May I add that the photograph which you so kindly inscribed to me is a constant inspiration." And then she continued, "It makes me feel that the very best I can do in this world is not nearly good enough, but it's worthwhile to keep on trying." So this is the kind of anxiety that you could interpret coming out of her visit, actually. Curie stayed more than a month in the US following her visit to Washington. She was celebrated at banquets, invited to cocktail parties, awarded honorary degrees at universities and colleges, She listened to songs composed in her honor, speeches that celebrated her achievements. But some of the best pictures or the photos that come out of the US tour, I think, comes from a visit to the Canonsburg Standard Chemical Company plant, the company that had extracted and produced her 1 gram radium, because it's actually one of the few instances in the iconography of Curie where you can see that she's, I don't know, she seems at home, if you will. Quite like these images. There are several of them from this day. As 3 out of 2,031 passengers carried by the USS Olympic on the most extensive passenger list since before the war, Curie left New York with Irène and Eve on June 25th. Among the 4,200 trunks and smaller packages and the 1,700 baskets of fruit and candy sent by friends of the passengers as sustenance, one piece of cargo stood out. Her radium had been placed in small vials and then locked into this lead box with a 5 centimeter thick casing and was stored in the strong room of the boat. In addition to the radium, she had received mesothorium and other ores estimated at $22,000 and cash of $6,684 as remuneration for talks and awards. The insurance letter for her total cargo is put at $137,437, a huge amount. So the tour may have been exhausting, but her trip had certainly been financially rewarding. So she came, she was seen, and she underperformed, at least according to the US press. But then what? Curie certainly returned to France richer in commodities and cash than when she left. But what she did not know was that as she left America, she left behind an impressive surplus in the fund that had been set up for the purchase of her gram of radium. And this surplus will be the cause of much hullabaloo in the years to come. Give or take a dollar to the sum of $60,000, and this is from the New York Times on July 30th, I think, 1921, which is somewhere around $731,000 today, it seemed as if the campaign had simply been too successful. Now, remember that it was of her own choosing that the gift came in the shape of radium and not in cash intended for its purchase. However, the money that was now left over in the trust fund was not tied up in minerals, nor did it require her to give any more speeches or talks. It was simply sitting there, waiting to be used. In that August following her visit, Maloney wrote Curie that the committee had decided to use this remaining sum to set up a trust fund in Curie's name, which would give her around $4,000 annually as long as she lived. And then the committee wanted it to go to the education of 2 American students in your science. Now, this seemed as a very generous offer, addressing both personal as well as professional needs. But deep down, Maloney perhaps suspected that this was not the kind of news that would go down well in Paris. She therefore quickly reassured her friend that she would approach a number of those people Curie had met in America who had not yet contributed to the campaign, in the hope that I shall be able to get from them a real free gift for the materialization of your dream and the hopes of Dr. Rigaud. So this idea of a real free gift begins to surface in their correspondence. And it seemed to imply money then for the Radium Institute. By the end of that month, and this is in the summer, of course, there was no reply from Curie. And now, you know, the post is clearly erratic. They often begin their correspondence by telling the other which letter they've read and so forth, and letters get crossed in the mail all the time. So Maloney is quite frustrated by the post, and she's getting more and more anxious that Curie is sulking in Paris, holding out on her. So what follows is a period when letters get crossed in the mail, with Maloney picking up enough courage to hint that perhaps the communication problem has something to do with Curie's vacationing at L'Arquest in Bretagne and mail stacking up in the Radium Institute in her absence. Unaware of the emotional storm that is probably now brewing on the Brittany coast, Maloney continued to field optimistic news about the possible book rights of the autobiography and about the money Curie could expect from the trust every 3 months. It is not until a curt letter from Curie from the end of September saying, "I don't quite agree with these decisions and I will write you a separate letter about this matter," that Maloney caught on to the fact that Curie was clearly displeased about these events. So Curie had received her American gift and she could not, in any shape or form, be seen to act greedily, because obviously this is not part of the Curie persona as it developed. She had to remain stoically disinterested in the money that she now knew could help her with her one major priority to secure the continued existence of the Radium Institute. So a private income and funds to cover student in whatever nationality was a complete disappointment to her. Perhaps Curie was secretly happy when she, in December that year, learned that the committee had hit an unexpected legal snag. It just proved impossible to make an endowment, an educational trust, out of this remaining money. Maloney now carefully writes to Curie that it had proved against the law in the United States to collect money from one purpose and then use it for another. Having purchased the radium, the law would actually compel her now to return the excess funds to those people who had contributed to the fund. So suddenly, Maloney's brilliant scheme was not so brilliant anymore. Because how could she and the committee solve the practical problems of asking all of these contributors, large and small, for their permission to turn the money into a trust for Marie Curie, and how could they be sure of the outcome? Curie is not pleased. She wanted to control the money for her laboratory, and she's much less interested in having them go to her personally. And this causes a rift, and this story is actually about the trust fund. It's such a complicated issue that you could build an entire lecture around the problems of the trust fund, which I haven't done. But in my book, I tried to go into the details exactly of how this fund, you know, the details of what I'm just trying now to go over fairly quickly. But this causes a real rift between the two, and it lasts a few months until the early spring of 1922, when Maloney for the first time makes a reference to Curie's ongoing work with Pierre Curie, asking if she would be interested in publishing this book in the US. "I think it would be a valuable little book," she concluded. And then she tells Curie something more important. She had found a fund in the US for around $1,000 for the purchase of American-made instruments that might be of some interest. In addition, she promised to put pressure on Mrs. Willard Strait, who never paid the $5,000 she pledged for the trust fund, or for the radium fund, and two other benefactors who have yet to make good on their promises. So the two women sort of begin anew, clean slate. Maloney again takes up her role as benefactor, rent collector, and Curie that of needy scientist. So they're back to their old sort of roles. And they keep up this correspondence pretty much like this for more than a decade. It's not difficult to understand how Curie benefited from her friendship with Maloney. Radium, honoraria, a trust fund, and now instruments. There was no end to what Maloney shipped from the US or provided her with. But what was in it for Maloney? The award that came from knowing she had helped the world's foremost female scientist to continue her work. Well, there was that, of course. And then there was the matter of publishing, which was her world. Maloney was a journalist, and her payment, perhaps, was in publications. She believed firmly that a woman's magazine is one of the biggest services that can be rendered in this country. So they keep up their correspondence. And of course, they do talk about private matters as well. I mean, they were on friendly terms, or personal friends, if you will, as well. But in the summer of 1925, Maloney sent Curie a very urgent letter regarding recent events in Orange, New Jersey, and she wrote, "There has been a controversy here in America as to the effects of radium upon the health of workers in watch factories and other factories where radium is handled. It is reported that 7 of these workers died at the chemical factory in Orange, New Jersey, during the past year. Dr. Harlow Brooks, who has been taking care of my husband in his long serious illness, has been at work on 2 of these cases. May I ask you if there are any reports on this subject available in Paris? And if so, if it would not be too much trouble to have someone send them to us here. She's always very sort of apologetic towards Curie. Dr. Brooks is particularly anxious to know the results of any post-mortems which might have been performed on workers with radium. Now, Curie responded very, very briefly to this, and she always began by stating that nothing had happened at the Radium Institute, there had never been an accident at the Radium Institute because of the careful precautions that had been taken at her laboratory, etc., etc. Now, this particular industry referring to here is, of course, had taken off during World War I when luminous watches and instruments became sought after practicalities of modern warfare, among other things. And the women Maloney referred to had painted the watches and dials with radium fluorescent paint by forming the brushes with their lips, so dipping them, taking up the brushes, forming them with their lips to get them fine-tipped enough for the small dials. And these women would later be known as the radium girls. Made terminally ill by their work, five of them initiated a lawsuit against the radium company, which not only changed US workplace safety rules forever, but also proved emphatically that radium was not only a healer, but a killer as well. And of course, the most famous example of this particular aspect of radium came a few years later when Pittsburgh millionaire Eben Byers suffered an excruciatingly painful death because of Radiotor, the infamous patent medicine that he had been taking for I think over a decade, for a very, very long time. And of course, the jaws sort of disintegrated on both the women and on Eben Byers. By now, Maloney had truly become a curist, a trafficker of instruments, and a networker for the networker. The correspondence between Curie and Maloney provides crucial insight, I think, into several of the strategies that Curie deployed in respect to radium. And it shows not only how Maloney, post-tour, emerged as a negotiator and mediator on Curie's behalf, but also how Curie used and relied on Maloney as a kind of keynote in this extended radium network, using her to ship instruments, to help produce texts, etc., etc. And Maloney enlisted professors, ambassadors, and friends to carry instruments with them to Paris when they went to France, trying to avoid any possible nuisance with customs, for instance. When her good friend and former chargé d'affaires at the Belgian embassy in Washington, Robert Silberkreuz, had to carry a galvanometer, I'm not sure how to pronounce it actually, instead of their old mutual friend Dr. Moore, she wrote, "I knew that with diplomatic passports, there would be no difficulty or delay or rough handling of this delicate instrument." Now, what to make of the trust fund after Curie's death? How to control it, how to hand it over to Irène. So this is a recurring problem that they will actually continue to discuss for as long as Curie basically lives. But in the spring of 1929, and there's always this discussion about them talking about Curie coming back to the US. She really wanted to go back to the US. And in 1929, Maloney reported that she hoped to organize a small group that could work more quietly and without much publicity for Curie's long-standing plans for a Polish radium institute. "We're trying to get $50,000, which would buy enough radium to start with, won't it?" she wrote to Curie. And this time, of course, it did. The price of radium had fallen to half of that in 1921, in large part then due to the discovery of radium-rich ores in Congo. There was no longer a shortage of the kind that had propelled radium to its unique status as a commodity in 1921. So Curie could now go to the US, she could take home another gram of radium, this time intended for her institute in Warsaw, at the bargain price of $50,000. So she returned in the fall of 1929 to America. There was a new president, Herbert Hoover, who received her at the White House, but all of this took place at much less fanfare and public notice than the trip 8 years previously. So I'll end with another nice touch that Maloney did for Curie The American gift may have been Maloney's brainchild, but it was the women of America that collected the money. So in a sense, of course, the American gift was also Maloney's gift to Curie, because she was the one who had sort of initiated it and pulled all the strings, but in a kind of distant, impersonal way. But Maloney also had a final personal gift to give to Curie, and it came in one of her final letters to Curie, which is dated June 6, 1934, so just a month, basically, before Curie dies. And this letter contains a small check for $57.88, so a very small amount. And when I went through their correspondence at the BNF, I was puzzled by the many small checks that Maloney regularly sent Curie over the years, actually since her first trip. There, all of these small checks, $50 here, $30 there, and you think, what is this? Until I realized that they were royalty for a book entitled The Log Cabin Lady, which was published in 1922 by Little Brown, and subtitled An Anonymous Autobiography. At first, I couldn't really understand, you know, what does this story of how a young, poor woman in the US Northwest who leaves her humble beginnings and becomes part of the New York glitterati have to do with Curie? It seemed sort of odd. The book, by the way, can be found at the Internet Archive if you want to have a look at it. As it turned out, the author of this book was none other than Maloney herself, who in the preface told readers that she had met the log cabin lady in question in 1920 at a lunch at the Colony Club in New York, where she had been invited to speak about Marie Curie. And she was sort of struck, you know, with this meeting of this living proof of the powerful transcendent values of American optimism, hard work, and egalitarian principles. And she asked this young woman if she couldn't tell her story, she wanted to publish it or make something of it so that people could read about it. But the woman in question didn't want to make the, you know, she didn't want to sign off with her own name. So Maloney promised her anonymity, and the log cabin lady was born. And this is one of the illustrations from that book, which says, "My first formal dinner in France was like a great family party." So this is, you know, the story of this very poor woman who grows up to become this society lady in New York. And somewhere along the line, and I haven't found out when, I'm sure I can, hopefully can backtrack to get to this stage, Maloney signed over the copyrights to Curie. And then she kept fielding the royalty checks to Curie. And Curie, of course, accepts them gracefully, but once she writes back to Maloney and she says, "It's really kind of you to do this, but I don't see why I have the benefit of it." So I don't think she really, I'm not sure if she really knew, but it's very, very sweet how these sort of small, tiny checks, you know, are being sent over to Curie at the same time as this enormous sums of money are being transferred to her for her research. And to end, I just want to say that Maloney had actually, I wouldn't say almost single-handedly, but I mean, it would be nice, and I think I mentioned that last time, to try and find out exactly how much money that went into Maloney's work, or how much money she fielded to Curie. Because, you know, here's Curie's research being funded for years, instruments coming her way, et cetera, et cetera. So the deed, the succession to Irene, the shipping and expensive instruments, the networking with the rich, she had done all of that and much more. And there's this very interesting letter at the end when it's becoming clear perhaps that, you know, they're talking about death more and more. They always spoke a bit about death, but they talk more and more about death. And it's becoming clear that, and Maloney sends Curie a long, long letter where she writes, "I've destroyed at least 50 of your letters. I didn't realize how many letters there were. I've destroyed so many letters, and if you want me to, I'll destroy even more." So they're sort of cleaning up the correspondence at the end of, in the beginning of the 1934. But the most intimate gift then that Maloney ever sent Curie, which is a tiny, tiny drop in the ocean of all the money that went her way, came from signing over copyright of this small book then. And she once wrote in a letter that this little book goes on working for you, which I think is a really nice end. Thank you. So I think I'm last to see.